from Vision Australia Radio, it's time to open the cellar door and uncork a classic on Heard It Through the Grapevine.
Hello, 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 he says, drawing a deep breath. I'm Michael Hintz, the Velvety Voice of Eno, with another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio and coming to you nationally through the Community Radio Network. And it's hello from my producer, Steve Phillips. Today, it's my pleasure to introduce the inimitable Ron Lawton from Jasper Hill Winery in Heathcote. Anyone who appreciates fine wine, especially Shiraz, will know Jasper Hill and its sublime wines. Ron is to Heathcote what Ross Brown is to Millewa. Mick and Dave Morris and Colin Campbell are to Rutherglen. John Ellis is to Hanging Rock and Kel Boynton to the Alpine Valleys. What he doesn't know about viticulture and viniculture isn't worth knowing. So it's fitting to celebrate Jasper Hill's 40th birthday this year by talking to Ron. Ron is a precise, conscientious man of wine. His precision and attention to detail reminds me a bit of the Riesling King John Vickery, a former food scientist who is making his, I think it's his 34th vintage this year.
Correct.
Good. Having put in the first plantings in 75, 76, and his daughter Emily is following in his footsteps as winemaker for the estate. Now, Jasper Hill, for those that don't know, is about 120 clicks northwest of Melbourne in Heathcote, Victoria. And it's named after the semi-precious jasper, a quartzite pressure rock found in black and red forms on the edge of the fault lines that run south-north, or north-south, we really should say, shouldn't we? Jasper Hill's two more really famed wines are named after Ron and Elva's daughters, Emily and Georgia. Emily's Paddock, Australia for a Fenced Field, is a 95% Shiraz, 5% Cabernet Franc blend, while Georgia's Paddock is pure Shiraz. Ron, welcome to Grapevine and happy 40th birthday.
Thank you, Michael.
Now, tell me about your early days in wine. What attracted you to Heathcote in the first place?
I was attracted to Heathcote because of the combination of many factors, but most particularly a seam of soil. Even though I trained in science, food science and chemistry specifically, I had the advantage of growing up on a farm.
Where did you grow up?
Oh, just on the hot, dry plains west of Melbourne.
Where is that?
My paternal forebears were Irish iron founders.
Oh, right.
And they came to Melbourne in the gold rush to make machinery for crushing quartz for the gold mines.
Oh, right.
And in fact, they were one of the first foundries ever established, and the first one was in North Melbourne,
yep,
when Melbourne was just a small colony. And they were early industrialists in Footscray.
Oh, they didn't, no relation to the Furfies, you know, the Furfies.
No relation, but similar sort of history.
Yep.
And after the gold petered out, that family turned, my family turned to making cast iron enameled baths.
Oh, right.
So a bit of trivia. Virtually every cast iron enameled bath in Australia has either of two trademarks on it.
Yep.
So one of them's a Lawton trademark.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
So, but having grown up on the farm, I had this feel for the soil, and I had lived in the UK for a couple of years. I lived in Liverpool for a couple of years in my previous occupation in the dairy industry.
Oh, right.
And
you've just come back from London, I believe, and you had an audience with the great Robert Parker, I believe.
Too right, yes. Mm.
Not only it went well?
It went extremely well.
Mm.
I'm still getting back to, it's a long-winded answer to your question about why Heathcote. The centre of the universe for me, but I came back from the UK having been exposed as a young adult to European wines, and
yes.
I suppose I was a bit of a, if I can use the term, a bit of a smart ass in those days.
Right.
And so I thought I could do better, and I wanted to grow Shiraz. I wanted to grow it on its own roots, i.e. not grafted to American rootstock.
Right.
I wanted to grow it without the need for irrigation, because I believe as a purist you shouldn't need to irrigate.
Yep.
And so all of those factors led me climatically to north of the Great Dividing Range in Victoria.
Yes.
But practically to Heathcote, because in Heathcote I found this lovely strip of what we now call the red Cambrian soil of Heathcote.
Yes.
Now, Australia is an ancient continent, and our soils are very shallow and not too fertile, but here
in Heathcote... A bit like some of our politicians, they
exactly,
say.
Exactly, exactly. But here in Heathcote, we have this strip of Cambrian soil that has soils derived from the decomposition of basalt that are 500 to 600 million years of age, but most importantly, they are extremely deep. So we've got soils that are 3 or 4 metres deep, and that, to me, was the indication that I could potentially grow my grapes without the need for irrigation. So that's why I went there.
And you were, well, the first in Heathcote, were you?
I wasn't
one
the,
of the first,
but I'm regarded
very
as,
early.
Yeah. I'm regarded as a pioneer of Heathcote, and I'm the one that has had continuity for the whole time.
Yep.
There were a couple of others, yeah, I'm the one that sort of made wine that's gone on to, for better or worse, fame.
And how many vintages in total under your belt today?
Yeah, 34 now.
34, that's it.
Not counting Northern Hemisphere vintages, which I do occasionally.
Do you?
Yes.
Oh, yes, that's right, because you have a relationship with Monsieur Chaputier.
Michel Chaputier, exactly.
Yes. Savard, and is that...
Both in Heathcote and in the Roussillon in France.
And Roussillon, yes. Yeah, makes some good wines there.
Too right.
Yes. Now, in these days of high technology and rapid change, it's pleasing to have that continuity in some things. Still the same single vineyard wine, still the same organic and biodynamic philosophies. To me, that's the hallmark of Jasper Hill and yourself. I call it the modernity of tradition.
Yes.
Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that, and it is to some degree an advantage, and I am very grateful that I have a daughter that's following in my footsteps, and in fact... She's been looking after the farm, so to speak, while I have been in London.
Yes.
It was an inopportune time to leave the farm.
Of course, it's a vintage, yes.
But it was one of those once-in-a-lifetime invitations from Robert Parker to go to London and speak and talk about your wine, and so I elected to do that. But thankfully, I've had Emily at home, and she's been put under pressure because it's probably the earliest vintage we've ever had.
Well, it's pretty early everywhere, isn't it?
It is.
I've been saying that in the Adelaide Hills and the Barossa, and I'm getting that sort of... Robert Parker who said, I think, whether it's down to this very special rift of dirt or not, these wines are simply incredible. So that's not a bad sort of accolade to have from...
I don't deliberately chase Robert Parker scores or points or anything, and I certainly don't make wine to suit his palate or his taster's palate, but I am... very grateful that he has appreciated my wines ever since he started to look at them. I started to export to the USA. Very small quantities are exported.
Mm-hmm.
We're still the same size as we started, along your point of of continuity. But we still export a little bit. So we started to export to the USA, I think about 1990.
Yeah.
And since then, Robert Parker has given my major wines points, even my Riesling.
Yes.
And for so many years, we've always scored somewhere between 90 and 97 points, so it's not a bad track record, but it's not the main thing that
good.
I live for.
Speaking of, you do a lot of things. I heard you sail, and you've got multifarious interests. That's a big word, isn't it, for this time of day?
Yeah.
But speaking of Riesling, of course, the great John Vickery is now back in action. He's working with Peter Lehman's son.
Oh, fantastic.
And he's made a wine... a Riesling, which I'm about to taste today, I think.
Fantastic.
Called John Vickery. It's
fantastic.
Good to see, isn't it?
It is good to see, yes.
Yeah. Now, your wines are really true expression of this modern term. I know it's not modern, really, in its origin, but it is in the use in Australia. Everyone's talking about Terroir, as they say in Australia, or Terroir, which is really, for those that don't know that, it's a sense of place, and the wine grape isn't the only thing that has terroir. In France, everything does. Everything that, if you can grow it and produce it in one area, everything does. So it's that you can go into a butter shop in Paris, and they have butter with different attributes from different terroir.
So, because of the different grasses that the different cows have been eating.
Exactly. Like there's a difference between Wagyu beef from there and Cape Grim beef and all that sort of thing. You must share something with the thorough, meticulous Rick Kinsbrunner, because he says it takes time and patience to master the making of different varietals, in his case Chardonnay, in your case Shiraz and more than Shiraz. You'd agree with that, isn't
it? I do certainly agree with it, and I think there's almost an art to making wine as well as the science, but if your aim is to express the place... the idea of the art is to do as little as possible.
Yes.
Because every time I interfere in the winemaking, the natural winemaking process, all I do is run the risk of damaging flavour or losing flavour. I don't create flavour. I don't even call myself a winemaker. I call myself a vigneron.
Vigneron, yes.
Because growing your grapes is the most important fact, because the vine creates the flavour. And an analogy is the great chefs of the world, they go to the market daily to buy the freshest food for their customers. Doesn't have to be the most expensive or the best, but they buy it the best and freshest. They take it back to their kitchen and they do as little as possible in the preparation of that food. In other words, they don't overcook it.
Are you listening, Heston? No,
and and winemaking is similar. In other words, for me to conserve as much of the flavour of the vineyard, I do as little as possible in the winemaking.
Yes, I asked this.
So it's that less is more principle.
Yes, and I asked this to a lot of people. I said, well, where does terroir finish and creative winemaking begin in the whole process? And it's where it's that point of where it intersects, I suppose. That's what...
Well, I am interfering because I am making decisions like what day will I harvest, for example, one of the major decisions that I have to make.
Yep.
So, yes, there is some human intervention in the terroir. I also made the decision to plant that variety in that place. Yep. That's a human intervention in the first place because that species not even native to that area, not native to Australia.
But your yeasts are wild.
Exactly, but my yeasts are wild or indigenous, as I like to call them.
Yes.
I started off wanting to, in my wines, not make the world's best wine, but wines that expressed my places, my two individual vineyards, to the best of my ability, with minimal interference. And so, yes, right from the outset, I was, into terroir. In fact, I was one of the first to start and use the word before even people could pronounce it in English.
Yes, still can't.
And I remember a story in the early press about Jasper Hill where I was called a terroirist.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, I don't like to use that term these days.
No, it's
very unpolitical.
Running a bit close to the bone, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Now, Heathcote has an enviable reputation, and you do, for fine Shiraz, but there's more to the region than just Shiraz. There are other varietals. What else is starting to come through? Because my prediction is that Heathcote's going to outrival the Yarra Valley, and few of us can afford to go down to the Mornington Peninsula, even though they make great wines. But
I don't
have a Range Rover, so I've just...
Heathcote is more Australian, if I can use that term. It's got rolling hills. It's got the continentality of climate being on the northern slopes of the Great Dividing Range, so it's not quite as green as some of the more southern parts of Victoria.
And it's a very long, narrow GI, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but it's not very long and narrow.
No, it just appears that way.
As a comparison, it's almost identical in size to Alsace in France.
Yes, yes.
And Alsace is not the biggest part of the area in
France.
It is only a small area. It's long and thin because it uses the Cambrian soil strip as the backbone for the region.
Yes. Well, you don't have the split personality of the Alsatians, do you?
I don't believe so. But
no. One day they're French and the next they're German, are they?
Exactly.
Depending on... Now, what are some of the styles, wine styles, that are emerging? Because Shiraz is a tick. I mean, that's the opera house of wines, isn't it, to Australia?
It has been proven in Australia, and it has been proven in Heathcote, I think.
Yep.
But I think there are potential other varieties. I've been growing a Riesling there as long as I've been doing Shiraz. There are not too many others doing it in Heathcote. But
now,
it makes a style that's... It's Heathcote Riesling.
Fairly full on, you'd say?
It's very full flavoured. It's got, deliberately, it's got some phenolics in there. It's not a pristine, fine Riesling. Mine has more citrus, lime, lemon, sometimes bitter grapefruit characters the floral characters of some of the South Australian regions.
Yes. How would you compare it, say, to the Strathbogie Rieslings, the Mitchelton and the and Goulburn?
I say it's unique in its own right.
Is it?
Yeah. as it expresses terroir.
Of course. Now, what other varietal do you think Heathcote, because Heathcote is for all its success, you don't want to be known as a one varietal region, do you?
Not. And
now, what that's what I'm getting at. What are the other varieties?
Because I'm experimenting, of course. You don't just sit back and do the same thing forever in the rest of your life. As an experiment, I have planted other varieties. I do make a Semillon. I have been making a Viognier.
A Nebbiolo?
I make, in particular, a Nebbiolo that has gained great success in the last few years. And I do have another vineyard 20K north of Emily's paddock, but still within the Heathcote region, where I've planted some Grenache. Because the northern part of the region is warmer and drier.
Yes, of course.
And so...
Let's talk about your Nebbiolo, because I usually have a wine of the week, and I selected, I think I had your Nebbiolo. Would you take us through, and I think it's the 2013 vintage, because I love that sort of gamey, meaty, tarry sort of. So look, this week's wine of the week is a 2013, or that's, you know, I'm putting the year before everything else, but technically I really should say it's a Jasper Hill Nebbiolo 2013 vintage. I don't know the alcohol. I think it was about 13, was it?
Yeah, it wasn't particularly high. I think it's 13.5 or something.
Is it 13.5? Yeah. And, of course, sealed under cork.
Everything I make is under cork.
Thank you. Now, take a note of that, people. Cork. Anyway, take us through the wine, Ron.
The Nebbiolo... In my period living in the UK, where I was exposed more to French wines, I hadn't been exposed to too many Italian wines, and those that I had were not really particularly exciting. And so after Jasper Hill opened its doors, cellar door in 1984, a request for an interview came from the late, great Mark Shield.
Oh, I remember Mark.
That used to write for The Age.
Yeah, he had a penchant for, he liked his gin, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. But apart from that, he wanted to come and see me. So he came up for lunch and he brought with him a bottle of Angelo Gaia's Barbaresco.
Oh, yes.
And he insisted that we have it for lunch. Well, that to me was a revelation. What have I been missing out on all these years? So that was 1984. And it took me until 1991 to actually... be able to purchase some planting material.
Where did you get it from?
Very little available. And Charles Sturt University imported half a dozen clones and propagated them, advertised some rootlings in the trade magazine, the grape grower magazine, in the classifieds at the back. Yep. I saw this and was immediately on the phone and purchased the entire entire batch.
Wouldn't have been much, anyway.
No, it was enough to plant 1 hectare.
1 hectare, that's... Ooh.
Yeah, and so they turned up, and I planted them immediately, and I took a phone call again about 2 weeks after they were planted from the university saying, we've made a mistake, we've actually sent you every single plant, we don't have any reference samples, can you actually send some back? So I had to go back out into the vineyard and uproot 24 vines and send them back.
Yeah.
And so that was the start. And so planted in 1991, under my conditions of viticulture and without irrigation deliberately, I take a long time to establish a mature adult plant. And so my first vintage was 1999. So it firstly took 8 years to...
And you don't have any trouble with, due to your elevation, around about...
1,000 feet.
1,000 feet. You don't have any trouble with acid, do you?
I certainly don't have any trouble with acid. No. In fact, that's a key to Heathcote's greatness, if I can say that, because virtually since I've been making wine in Heathcote under my conditions, I find that all of my wines have sufficient natural acidity and don't need any adjustment.
Yeah.
And I sort of joke that I've still got the same bag of tartaric acid I bought back in 1982.
It's probably solid by now.
No, it's been open and some has been removed, but that's not quite good. I do have another second bag. It's replaced it, so
So the wines, I find Italian wines, they're not... they don't have the same nose as Australian wines. You know, you can pick up an Australian wine and get the aroma. But with Italian wines, they can be a bit dumb on the nose at first. But then if you got the patience, I had an Italian Merlot there, and it was just silky.
Yeah, the characteristics of Nebbiolo are tar and roses are the classic descriptors.
Well, that's Don Lewis, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I don't particularly know that I like a lot of dominant tar, but I certainly do... I do appreciate the floral character of Nebbiolo, and yep. mine does have a floral character.
And that sort of meaty, gamey, and
that meaty, gamey,
chewy,
very savoury.
Savoury yeah, component.
But then the key component of a great Nebbiolo is that great tannic punch at the end.
Yes, yes.
Like it almost sucks the juice out of your eyeball, so to speak.
That reminds me. Yes, yeah, it does, doesn't
it? I didn't coin that phrase.
It creeps up on you, doesn't it?
And so it leaves your mouth, nice and dry at the finish.
A bit like some of Andrew Sutherland Smith's Durifs from up at Rutherglen.
Yeah, but maybe quite not as massive, yeah.
Not as massive, no, but heading towards that.
Maybe a little more supple. And so deliberately, if I have any tricks in the winemaking stage, virtually all of my red wines, I deliberately macerate for a very long period, like 6 weeks. So from the day it's harvested through the initiation of its natural fermentation without any yeasts being added, so it's indigenous yeast fermentation, through to the pressing off of the wine, the resulting wine from the skins and pips, 6 weeks.
6 weeks, yeah.
And that gives my tannins a better structure.
Yes.
Not necessarily more massive, but just a better structure in the mouth. Yeah.
Mm.
And, of course, it means I've got to have lots of fermenting tanks, so it's a luxury for me. But being small, I can do that, yeah.
But, of course, you've gone with your wood, which is French oak, of course.
Yeah.
Nothing as presumptuous as raw as American oak.
Yeah.
But you've gone to bigger barrels, haven't you, over the time?
Only for the Grenache.
Only for the Grenache, is it?
No, all my Shiraz.
All the rest Shirazes are the same.
Shiraz and Nebbiolo are still in barriques. Yeah.
Still in barriques. Yeah. But in the
of which about 20% are new.
Yeah.
But the Grenache is a very easily oxidised grape, and I think it benefits from the bigger barrels with thicker staves and less oxygen permeation and less surface-to-volume ratio. Yeah.
Yep. And how's your collaboration with Michel Chaputier going, anyway?
Fantastic.
What's he like to work with?
We're soulmates.
And what have you learned from him, and what's he learned from you?
It does go both ways.
Yeah, it certainly does.
Michel, as a young Turk in
in
France, was constrained by the rules, by the AOC rules. And, to go outside the AOC rules can be the kiss of death in many people's eyes.
Yes.
But and so to do any experimentation and just to learn more, he had to leave France to experiment. And so, to cut a long story short, the world was his oyster, and he ended up with me in Heathcote.
Mm.
Says something about the region, I suppose. He did his research. He tried my wines. We became instantaneous friends simply because we were so identical in philosophy.
Yes.
We're totally different in culture. We're totally different in age. We're totally different in stature, and particularly the cultural side. But nevertheless, we get on very well. We are friends that are in business.
And of course that you would have learnt something from him.
Well, I've learnt from him. I started off being organic.
Yes.
As a chemist, I could see from the inside looking out. I didn't like the idea of this overuse of agrochemicals that was coming about. When I graduated, Rachel Carson had just published Silent Spring, which was the sort of first publication to start and alert the world that maybe these agrochemicals can potentially do harm to the environment and specifically harm to humankind.
And
as
that's
well.
Been picked up by Alice Feeling.
That's been picked up by everyone since then. But she was sort of was the start. And so I took that on board. And being a farmer's son as well, I could see my father being hoodwinked, I thought, into thinking that to be a modern farmer, you should use these modern concoctions of chemicals. Yes. Well,
it's a bit like technology today, isn't it?
Yeah, well, my attitude was we've been farming for quite a few thousand years without them. Why do we need them? And, of course, the answer is to be lazy or to do it quicker or cheaper. Yeah.
Yes.
I didn't want to go down that track. And so I'd been organic since inception.
Mm-hmm.
From the inside looking out, I didn't like what I saw with agrochemicals.
Mm-hmm.
After a few years of doing that, being organic is being passive. That's not using synthetic chemicals. But it was starting to bother me that potentially every time I sold a bottle of a wine away from the property, I was removing part of the place.
Yes.
And if you think about the building blocks for the flavour and colour molecules, where are they coming from? They're obviously coming from the soil. And so every time I remove some, a vineyard is not a closed system. I'm actually removing part of the place every time I sell it off the premises. And so I was worried about how I could replace what I was losing mm-hmm. in each bottle of wine. And the quick answer, of course, is to tip on fertilizer, nitrogen, yes. potassium, yeah. and phosphorus.
Phosphorus, yes.
However, that bothered me still because I would then be changing the place to reflect the terroir yes. of the fertiliser
yes.
factory.
Yes.
So that wasn't the answer.
Yes.
Eventually, my search led me to biodynamics, and,
yes.
and that was about the same time that I became friends with Michelle. Yes. Michelle had already made that conversion. Yep. As an eighth yep. generation French winemaker, he'd already made that conversion.
Mm.
So biodynamics is not voodoo, it's not mumbo-jumbo.
No.
There is a science behind it as far as I'm concerned.
Mm.
It's a matter of keeping your soil alive and healthy with living organisms.
Yes.
So it's compost, not fertilizer, that's the key.
Compost, not yes, yeah. yes. Yeah.
And so from Michelle, I got that impetus.
What
yeah.
would he have learned from you, do you think? Are you a good teacher? Are you a patient person?
We both spoke on the rostrum at yes. Robert Parker's event last Sunday and
would have
last Saturday rather.
Fly on the wall there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And one of the key things that Michelle said in his
yep.
talk was that he appreciates that in the old world people are locked into techniques, locked into to tradition, but the new world has many more people like myself, young bloods that have got far more energy
yes.
and are prepared to express that energy rather than just inheriting the business and going on and on and on with the same thing.
And that's what any wine region needs, isn't
and
it?
That,
you need
so
that
it was this
tension between...
This was the impetus that yes. I gave to Michelle. So yes. I gave Michelle even more energy, I think.
Did you?
Yeah. He's a pretty energetic man in his own right. But
I've heard that.
Yeah.
mm.
So we get on pretty well.
Mm. Well, look, we're just about getting towards... That's just about it for today. The time is just tempus fugit. Time flies. I'll just finish on this quote, if I may, and it's from someone I've got a lot of time for. It's got a good palate and writes well, Andrew Jefford, I think. No Shiraz in Australia has reflected its site and its vintage with more fidelity down the years than Ron Lawton's Jasper Hill, the wine which first sprung a spotlight onto Heathcote. I think that's a beautiful summation of yourself and Heathcote. And look, it's been a real pleasure. I think it's the first time we've met. It's been a pleasure talking to you today. And thank you for your time and coming down, sparing your time, especially during vintage, Ron.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, that's about your lot for now. My research material was sourced from my home library, winebiz.com, and The Guardian, or the Aussie Guardian. This has been another Heard It Through the Grapevine on Vision Australia Radio, heard on all stations around Australia via the Community Radio Network. It's cheers from me, Michael Hintz, and please drink moderately.
Heard It Through the Grapevine is a production of Vision Australia Radio. Sound information.